And the winner is...
Filmmakers love awards. They love handing awards out. They even love making films about awards. But above all, they love winning awards. And the most coveted are those given by the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the Oscars.
The highest award within our power to bestow.
2019 sees the 91st Academy Awards, and speculation is as fevered as ever as to which of this year's contenders will scoop the big prizes.
Stop worrying and think how nice that statue is going to look on your mantelpiece.
Over the course of nine decades, patterns have emerged in Oscar's tastes. He prefers some kinds of films to others. They add up to a set of mini-genres in their own right, with their own rules and hidden structures.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
And if you can nail those, well, then it's time to start practicing your acceptance speech.
Thank you for believing in me.
So, ladies and gentlemen, roll out the red carpet and take your seats, because tonight I'll be revealing the secrets of winning an Oscar.
And the Oscar goes to...
Yes!
Now, bear with me for a moment while I get a few things off my chest. All awards are essentially foolish, but none more so than the Oscars. For proof, consider this. In 1942, Citizen Kane didn't win the Oscar for Best Picture, but in 1990, Driving Miss Daisy did. Just think about that for a moment and try to imagine a world in which Driving Miss Daisy was the very best film you were going to see that year.
What are you doing?
I'm trying to drive you to the stove.
Or even the best Morgan Freeman film of the year. In fact, when it first opened in the US in December 1989, Driving Miss Daisy wasn't even the best Morgan Freeman film of the week. That was Ed Zwick's Glory, a drama about the American Civil War's first all-black volunteer company. But Oscar thought otherwise. Ask any film fan how seriously you should take the Academy Awards, and chances are they'll remind you that Charlie Chaplin, Orson Welles...
They've been making statues for 2,000 years, and I've only been buying for five.
David Lynch...
Arrangements are being made, and I will meet you at the private Portland Airport.
OK, Gordon.
And most famously, Alfred Hitchcock never won a Best Director Oscar.
Thank you.
Nor did Howard Hawks, Stanley Kubrick, or, so far, Jane Campion. In 2014, Steve McQueen became the first black filmmaker ever to bag a Best Picture Oscar with 12 Years a Slave. Although he was beaten to Best Director, as was Barry Jenkins, so if Spike Lee wins this year, that'll be a first. Women have traditionally been shut out of the festivities too. It wasn't until 2010 that Kathryn Bigelow finally broke the glass ceiling in the Best Director category with The Hurt Locker. This year, the Best Director list is, once again, all male. Worth noting, too, that no animated feature has ever won Best Picture. And if Roma gets the top prize this year, it'll be the first film made entirely in a foreign language ever to do so. The Academy Awards are hardly cutting edge. And yet, in the past few years, I've found myself cheering Oscar Best Picture winners, like Moonlight. And most recently, The Shape of Water, suggesting that either I'm getting soft or the Oscars are getting better. And like it or not, the Oscars do mean something, not least because they've created a canon of films about which we can have a good old-fashioned argument. And underpinning that canon is a whole set of secrets of cinema, because certain kinds of films, certain themes, particular types of character win again and again. So let's take a look at Oscar's favourites, beginning with the oldest of all. At the 1979 Academy Awards, the two most talked about nominations were for Michael Cimino's The Deer Hunter and Hal Ashby's Coming Home.
Not a charm.
Both took on the most painful and divisive event in recent American history, the Vietnam War. Now, while there'd been a whole raft of violent movies like Deliverance and Straw Dogs that could be read as thinly veiled allegories, honouring films like Coming Home and The Deer Hunter, which faced the traumas of Vietnam head on, looked like a daring move on the part of the Academy. But in fact, they were variations on a favourite Oscar formula, the War is Hell film. It was a film about World War I, William Wellman's Wings, that triumphed at the debut ceremony in 1929. And while it may be 50 years older, Wings has a lot in common with The Deer Hunter. Both films begin by establishing their main characters in their pre-war civilian lives. Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken and John Savage work at a steel plant. For all the drinking and swearing, in their own way, they're as untested and innocent as Charles Rogers and Richard Arlen's love rivals in Wings. What unites these characters is that they have no idea what's about to hit them. The carnage and suffering of their military service is depicted in unflinching detail. These films have much in common with rites of passage movies, tapping deep into the idea of loss of innocence. That isn't the kind of theme that preoccupies the makers of popular war films like The Guns of Navarone or Where Eagles Dare. But awards winners have to deliver more than men on a mission thrills. They have to say something about the human condition, usually that war is hell and even its heroes are martyrs. Note how many Oscar winners climax with the death of a protagonist or a significant major character. Look at All Quiet on the Western Front, which won the third ever Best Picture Award in 1930. Lou Ayer's young hero is almost casually potted by a sniper as he reaches for a butterfly. It's tragic and symbolic. In The Deer Hunter, Cimino makes great play of the titular veteran lining up, but then sparing his prey because of his traumatic experiences in battle. Another symbolic moment. Okay. So, for all its supposedly edgy and challenging subject matter, The Deer Hunter draws on reliable Oscar-winning precedents, as does Coming Home.
Luke? Can I come in?
On the surface, this looks like a very different kind of film.
How you doing?
Living is easy with eyes closed.
It centres on the romance between Jane Fonda's military wife and John Voight's paraplegic veteran, and it's set in California. But it also echoes an earlier Oscar-garlanded film that was a huge hit with audiences as well.
Boy, the old hometown hasn't changed very much, has it?
No.
William Wyler's The Best Years of Our Lives is the story of three servicemen returning home after World War II. Although it's set entirely on Civvy Street, like Coming Home, it's a powerful study of the cost of war.
Cheers.
Frederick March's infantryman come banker Al struggles with alcohol.
Aren't you drinking?
Gdansky, get out of that plane!
And the post-traumatic stress of Air Force Captain Fred, played by Dana Andrews, is vividly evoked using music and sound effects.
Gdansky! Wake up!
Gdansky! She's burning up! Get out! Get out!
I've learned how to take this harness off.
Ex-sailor Homer is the most obvious casualty of the three, having lost his hands and then had them replaced by prosthetic hooks. Non-professional actor Harold Russell was an actual double amputee as a result of his own military service. The film garnered an extraordinary 8 Oscars, including one honorary award.
Bullshit!
Coming Home
Bullshit!
Scored just 3, with John Voight and Jane Fonda scooping Best Actor and Actress alongside a Best Screenplay win. Now, in my opinion, the fact that Coming Home didn't win Best Picture in 79 and The Deer Hunter did is also one of the great injustices of Oscar history.
Say something else, fuck.
I'm not the enemy.
But perhaps The Victory of the Deer Hunter, a film which was dogged with allegations of hysterical racism and exploitative xenophobia, tells us something else about the Academy Awards, that flag-waving is always a favourite. In 1987, nearly a decade after The Deer Hunter's triumph, Platoon won 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Oliver Stone, who, unlike Cimino, had seen active combat in Vietnam, earning a Bronze Star and Purple Heart. Platoon ticks a typical war is hell box by focusing on Charlie Sheen's newly arrived infantry volunteer Chris Taylor, a figure of innocence and a clear stand-in for Stone himself. Chris is quickly caught up in a highly symbolic conflict between Tom Berenger's brutal Staff Sergeant Barnes and Willem Dafoe's kindly and humane Sergeant Elias.
You're humping too much stuff, Troop. You don't need half that shit. I'll haul it for you. But next time you check with me first, all right?
In fact, the film is so explicitly symbolic that when Elias is betrayed, he meets his death in a cruciform pose, as if Defoe was auditioning for his subsequent lead role in Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. Unlike many previous winners, Platoon featured no scenes set back at home and focused almost exclusively on the tripwire life-or-death struggles of its male characters. And although they're very different movies, Stone's film laid the ground for a much more recent Oscar winner. The Hurt Locker swaps the jungles of Southeast Asia for dusty, bleached-out Baghdad. Unlike Platoon, it's not a movie about loss of innocence. The explosive ordnance disposal team it follows are experienced, highly trained soldiers, and much of the film's fascination lies in the detail of how they disarm a range of deadly devices. But see how, like Stone's movie, The Hurt Locker vividly evokes the day-to-day job of a soldier, the daily grind of dangerous assignments.
Get out of the way.
And despite Bigelow's documentary-like approach, the film is still peppered with moments of familiar cinematic symbolism. Is this fiery inferno reminding us that war is hell?
We've already seen that the first and third Best Picture Oscars went to war films, but the second winner, in 1930, established a very different Academy favourite. Not only was The Broadway Melody the first musical to win Best Picture, it was also the first talkie to do so.
Winnie, I don't want you to answer me like that again. Then keep your nose out of my business. Your business is my business.
The Broadway Melody proved the perfect vehicle to showcase the possibilities of full sound pictures, a talking, singing, dancing, dramatic sensation.
Look at them in their places, look at the fancy laces, look at them as they smile, all star away.
Since then, the musical has remained a firm favourite with the Academy. Over the years, the Best Picture Award has gone to such splashy, super-produced hits as Gigi, West Side Story, The Sound of Music, Oliver, and Chicago.
Now, it's worth reminding ourselves that the actual subjects of these films were, respectively, sexual grooming, juvenile gang violence, Nazi oppression, child slavery, and a murder trial. But, let's be honest, we tend to forget all that heavy stuff and concentrate instead on the delights of musical winners, the songs and dances, and often the cutting edge and even experimental cinematic techniques.
Like the 20-minute ballet featuring homages to Impressionist painters, which Gene Kelly cooked up in Vincent Minnelli's An American in Paris. Or the superb on-location choreography of Jerome Robbins in Robert Wise's West Side Story. And, of course, that dizzying mountain shot from the opening of The Sound of Music.
The hills are
It doesn't matter that many of these winners were originally created for the stage. Translated to the big screen, they become a showcase for what cinema can do. How can the Academy resist? Because the Oscars are an industry award, it's no surprise that films set within the entertainment business appeal to voters.
Now, of course, musicals are the very definition of show business, which in turn provides the perfect material for a song and dance film. The Artist, which triumphed in 2011, followed in the footsteps of Singin' in the Rain by taking us back to the birth of sound, using the techniques of silent cinema to create a drama in which the key language is music. Among the film's five Oscar wins, including Best Picture, was one for Ludovic Bors's score. Sometimes the dancing in cinema isn't done by the actors, but by the camera.
You okay, man?
Take Alejandro González Iñárritu's Birdman, the Best Picture winner in 2015.
Do you know where to go?
Yeah. I know where to go.
Here, Michael Keaton plays Regan Thompson, a washed-up actor struggling to reinvent his career years after his prime playing a superhero in the 1990s. Sound familiar? Although there are no song and dance numbers in Birdman, the camera is choreographed with a dexterity that would put a spring in Gene Kelly's step. The film uses digital technology to create what looks like a seamless and often spectacular single shot, twirling around the set from scene to scene with the grace of a ballerina.
Ladies and gentlemen, I owe my entire success to beef, iron and wine.
At the heart of so many of these showbiz pictures is the fickle nature of fame and the sense that, almost like a law of physics, for new stars to rise, others have to fall. In 1932, a film about movies, What Price Hollywood, scored a nomination for Adela Rogers' St. John's and Jane Murfin in the category of Best Writing Original Story. It didn't win, but that story was fairly quickly recycled in a more elaborate form and went on to be remade three times over the next eight decades.
And now we arrive at the climax of the annual dinner of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
It's been a magnet for nominations in every one of its incarnations.
We have already applauded with our hearts as well as our hands, Miss Vicki Lester.
Ladies and gentlemen, when something like this happens to you, and you try to tell how you feel about it, you find that out of all the words in the world,
just two stick in your mind. Thank you. And all I can do is to say them to you from my heart. And
hey, let go of my goddamn arm. Hey, let go of my arm. Christ. I'm sorry, baby, I can't find my place. They don't seem to have a place for me down here.
Interestingly, the first incarnation of A Star Is Born was not a musical. It was set in the world of acting and didn't feature songs. Those arrived in the second version, directed by George Cukor and starring Judy Garland and James Mason, which took this behind-the-scenes tale and added the musical element.
A theme that was picked up in the 1976 Barbra Streisand version, in which the heroine changed from being an actor to a singer. Evergreen, Julie won the Oscar for Best Song.
The latest incarnation, directed by Bradley Cooper, who stars alongside pop icon Lady Gaga, also stays in this musical world. And once again, it's attracted a clutch of Oscar nominations.
Tell me something, girl. Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more?
What's significant is that a story that began life as an exposé of the truth about Hollywood turned almost organically from a drama into a musical, as if any film about Hollywood would eventually break into song.
Gonna give America the English Derby Cup.
He's gonna give America the English Derby Cup.
A Yankee Doodle Dandy, Yankee Doodle do or die.
It's no coincidence that the Best Actor and Best Actress awards have often gone to stars playing other stars, whether real or fictional. Such roles provide the opportunity to do a song and dance on stage and demonstrate heartache and tragedy off stage. Using his own hoofing and warbling skills, James Cagney won in 1943 as real-life song and dance man George M. Cohan in Yankee Doodle Dandy, while Barbara Streisand shared the only ever joint Best Actress award as vaudeville legend Fanny Brice in Funny Girl.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade.
What'd you get me a guitar for?
Because I like the way you sing.
Well, I was born a coal miner's daughter.
Sissy Spacek and Reese Witherspoon both triumphed playing country stars, respectively Loretta Lynn in Coal Miner's Daughter and June Carter in Walk the Line. And 2019 has seen Rami Malek nominated for his portrayal of Freddie Mercury, with Bohemian Rhapsody in contention for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture.
Mama, just killed a man.
But you don't always have to play a big name to win big. Sometimes small can be beautiful.
Let's call this genre Ordinary People, in homage to Robert Redford's debut film as a director, which won a handful of Oscars in 1981, including Best Picture and Best Director.
It's a weighty examination of how a family reacts to the death of one son and the attempted suicide of another. The film that American critic Roger Ebert astutely praised for sidestepping the sophisticated suburban soap opera it could easily have become.
It's cold out here. You should put that on, or do you want a sweater?
Do I need one?
Key to its success are some great performances, not least Mary Tyler Moore, one of the biggest TV stars of the 60s and 70s, known previously for playing lovable ditzy city girls, but here cast against type as an uptight middle-class mother frozen by grief.
You know, that animal next door, that Pepper or Pippin, whatever
Pippin,
his name
Pippin,
is.
Pippin, Pippin.
He's not a very friendly dog. I don't care what Mr. McGreery says.
What he really
he's
wanted
really
was
not.
The retriever
he's...
that was down the street for
and
sale.
And every time
That's
that dog
wanted,
comes into this backyard and I try to get him out, he...
In some respects, Ordinary People fits neatly into that group of films in which the Academy, whose membership is disproportionately weighted toward actors, rewards an actor for their debut stint behind the camera, because, as we all know, what all actors really want to do is direct.
Think of Kevin Costner's triumph directing Dances with Wolves.
But they'll never take our freedom!
Or Mel Gibson winning big with Braveheart.
I came here to take my son home. And I realise he already is home.
Ordinary People followed another dysfunctional family saga, Kramer vs. Kramer, which had scooped Best Picture the previous year. The social dramas have often been rewarded in the acting categories, with Oscars going to performers like Halle Berry in Monsters Ball or Monique in Precious, both of which deal with tough issues mm-hmm. in a gritty, realistic manner.
But to win Best Picture often takes something a little lighter.
If you'd ask me real nice, I might put that bag up there for you.
In 1935, Frank Capra's It Happened One Night became the first movie to sweep the board at the Oscars, winning Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress and Best Screenplay. The film's success was a surprise. Claudette Colbert was so convinced she wasn't going to win that she was heading off on a cross-country rail trip on the night of the ceremony. Studio boss Harry Cohn had to send someone to drag her off the train when it turned out she'd won. Cleverly, It Happened One Night deftly combines sharp social commentary with crowd-pleasing screwball comedy, in much the same way that Capra's It's a Wonderful Life mixed film noir with sentimental drama.
Gable plays a working-class reporter and Colbert a spoilt socialite. When they're thrown together on a bus journey, their two worlds collide and sparks fly.
Why, you ungrateful brat.
Aboard! All aboard!
It may have become a rom-com classic, but It Happened One Night was made at the height of the Depression, and the anxieties of the time are clearly on show in the hardship of the people in trailer parks and bus depots.
You know, there's something about your manner. It's like you're trying to toy with me.
That's right, Aurora. I'm playing with
no,
you.
No, this is the element. This is exactly...
Do you want to play, Aurora?
50 years later, we find a similar interplay between comedy and drama in the 1984 Best Picture winner Terms of Endearment. Here, the uptight heroine, played by Shirley MacLaine, and the cheeky, straight-talking ex-astronaut, played by Jack Nicholson, spar in a manner which echoes Gable and Colbert. The characters are older, but the banter is at times strikingly similar. Like its predecessor, Terms of Endearment won a clutch of big awards, including Best Picture and Director for James L. Brooks, Actress for Shirley MacLaine, and Supporting Actor for Nicholson.
Fly me to the moon, the moon.
Compare these bedroom scenes from the two films. It Happened One Night was a pre-Hays Code comedy, meaning this was racy for the time.
Perhaps you're interested in how a man undresses.
Well, I was just sitting here, realizing that I had never shown you my Renoir.
What are you talking about?
First the right, and the left. After that, it's every man for himself.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? The big bad wolf? The big bad wolf? She's afraid of the big bad wolf. Tra-la-la-la-la.
Don't you realize I'm a grandmother?
Would you mind, please, putting out the light?
No, not at all.
I like the lights on.
Then go home and turn them on.
In 1960, the midway point between these two pictures, MacLaine appeared in Billy Wilder's brilliant comedy The Apartment, a classic Oscar-winning tale of ordinary people. In one way, it's an embittered look at the cruel, brutal exploitation of the corporate world, but it's also an irresistible romantic comedy that trumps an attempted suicide with a sweet, tough, tart, but essentially optimistic resolution.
I love you, Miss Kubelik.
Three. Queen.
Did you hear what I said, Miss Kubelik? I absolutely adore you.
Shut up and deal.
Our own king of the socially conscious drama is, of course, Ken Loach, whose films have earned major awards recognition in Europe, but have never been seen as Oscar contenders. Loach's countryman Mike Lee has been Oscar-nominated seven times, but never won, even though his films are shot through with humour. Other British directors, however, have found that sweet spot between social realism and movie magic. John Schlesinger made Midnight Cowboy, the first Best Picture winner to earn a US X rating. The final scenes depict a man dying of emphysema on a bus ride with a male prostitute. But the performances of Dustin Hoffman and John Voight and the combination of music and image make this a transcendent moment of cinema. And that sense of sweetness is heightened by John Barry's memorable harmonica theme, which I once had the privilege of playing with the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra and which never fails to melt an audience's heart. Forty years later, Danny Boyle's Best Picture winner Slumdog Millionaire, loosely adapted from Vikas Swarup's novel Q&A, took the poverty-stricken plight of street kids in Mumbai and turned it into an uplifting human drama coloured by the lively inflections of Bollywood movies.
Give me a hand. Let your head rest in my hand. Relax. I got you, I promise. I'm not gonna let you go. Hey, man, I got you.
And most recently, Barry Jenkins' sublime Moonlight proved that an indie film with potentially niche appeal could win Best Picture when universalized by unexpectedly dazzling visuals and a superb use of music. No wonder it beat La La Land to the top prize. And speaking of outside contenders, there's one small but important group of Oscar winners that reveals key clues about the narrative tropes and character types that the Academy hold most dear. In March 1975, a little-known Italian-American actor called Sylvester Stallone watched a boxing match between Muhammad Ali and Chuck Wepner. Ali was heavyweight champion of the world, Wepner a minor fighter with little hope of finishing the bout, the classic underdog. In the event, Wepner was only seconds short of going the full distance when he lost on a technical knockout. Stallone, himself a Hollywood outsider and underdog whose roles had included the softcore romp The Party at Kitty and Studs, a.k.a. Italian Stallion, and the cult film The Lords of Flatbush, immediately started work on a script about a boxer, which he then sold on the condition that he starred in it. Against the odds, the studio agreed, provided the budget was kept low. The result was Rocky. In Stallone's story, the hero loses the fight, but crucially is still standing at the end. A huge box office hit in 1976, Rocky picked up both Best Picture and Best Director the following year.
Here it's chaos. Rocky, you went the distance. You went the 15 rounds. How do you feel?
All right, all right.
What are you thinking about when that buzzer sounds for that line? Adrian! What do you think about when the 15th round when you're coming out?
Adrian!
You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
In doing so, it knocked out a couple of big hitters. Network, a razor-sharp media satire.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Forget it. We don't want you to do anything that would embarrass you that you don't feel right about. Forget it.
And the acclaimed Watergate drama, All the President's Men. Like so many sports movies, Rocky features a training montage, the transformative, stirring sequence that's a staple of the genre. It ends with one of cinema's most iconic shots as our hero dances at the top of the steps to Philadelphia's Museum of Art. Ever since, they've been called the Rocky Steps.
Keep them
28 years later, we find a very similar training sequence in Million Dollar Baby, Clint Eastwood's tale of underdog female pugilist Maggie Fitzgerald and Frankie Dunn, the grizzled trainer who helps give her a shot at glory. It's the only other boxing film to win Best Picture and Director, but unlike Rocky before her, Maggie isn't left standing. A profoundly downbeat ending brought criticism from some groups, prompting Eastwood to say that the film was about the American dream, albeit expressed in the arc of a Greek tragedy.
You remind me of my daddy.
Well, he must have been a very intelligent, handsome man.
Million Dollar Baby netted Hilary Swank a Best Actress Oscar, putting her in a tradition of Academy Award-winning movie boxers, which includes Wallace Beery for The Champ way back in 1932, Marlon Brando for On the Waterfront, Christian Bale for The Fighter, and perhaps most famously, Robert De Niro for Raging Bull. One last bout, one last shot at redemption. The point is not about winning, but going the distance. Now, it should be noted that the plucky underdog theme isn't restricted to boxing pictures.
The wonderfully funny and moving script by Steve Teshich for the cycling movie Breaking Away was rewarded in the 1980 ceremony. The Cutters, a motley crew of working-class small-town boys, face the wealthy and privileged university team in a cycle race and succeed in triumphing against the odds. And of course, the most celebrated British sporting entry is 1981's Chariots of Fire, the story of not one but two underdogs who overcome prejudice and class snobbery to win Olympic gold. Chariots of Fire has a blend of music and image imitated ever since. Vangelis's theme tune laid down the perfect track, and Chariots ran away with four big awards.
Simple Jack, the story of a mentally impaired farmhand who can talk to animals, was a...
Ben Stiller's Hollywood satire Tropic Thunder reinforces the most oft-repeated canard about the Oscars.
In a weird way, I had to sort of just free myself up to believe that it was okay to be stupid or dumb.
To be a moron.
Yeah.
To be moronical.
Exactly. To be a moron.
An imbecile.
Yeah.
Like the dumbest motherfucker that ever lived.
It's the claim that the easiest way to win an acting award is to play someone facing, and often overcoming, a physical or mental challenge, be it illness, injury, addiction, or disability. Now, look at the last 30 years alone, and by my reckoning, well over a quarter of Best Actress awards and a third of Best Actor awards have gone to people playing characters that would broadly fit into this category.
But the idea that these are somehow easy wins is nonsense. Far from it. In fact, they're often very demanding roles and they encompass a wide range of characters and performances. The role that seems to have embedded the theme of disability in the Academy's consciousness is Dustin Hoffman's autistic Raymond Babbitt in 1988's Rain Man. While Rain Man was praised in some quarters for raising public awareness of autism, it's a spectrum of which Raymond's form is highly unusual. He's an autistic savant, and although he's withdrawn, some of his mental skills, including memory and counting, function at an almost superhuman level.
You watching that?
Yeah.
You seeing that, Ray? You catching that?
Yeah, falling on the ground.
Okay, now what do I have left?
Two jacks, 1-8, 1-king, 1-6. Two aces, 1-10, 1-9, 1-5.
1-5. You are beautiful, man.
Rain Man won a handful of awards, including Best Actor and Best Picture, in 1989. A feat repeated in 1995 by Forrest Gump.
Congratulations. How do you feel?
I gotta pee.
I believe he said he had to go pee.
Tom Hanks' Forrest faces very different challenges to Raymond. He has somewhat unspecified learning impairment reflected in a low IQ. But Forrest also has exceptional athletic skills, which see him become a top American footballer. A world-class ping-pong player and a transcontinental runner.
This is a recurrent theme for the kind of roles that win Oscars, the portrayal of a character who has a disability but who is also blessed with a special gift.
In 1990, the year after Dustin Hoffman won Best Actor for Rain Man, Daniel Day-Lewis triumphed with his own extraordinary transformative performance. My Left Foot is the story of Christy Brown. Born with cerebral palsy, he grows up in poverty in 1930s Ireland. Christy's life is the very definition of struggle, and in Day-Lewis's remarkably physical performance, you can see Christy's rage and frustration all but bursting out of his body. A turning point in his life comes when he demonstrates that he can write and draw with his left foot. Christy goes on to become a talented painter and an author, a story all the more inspiring because it's based on real events. And As, of course, was 2014's The Theory of Everything, featuring Eddie Redmayne's Oscar-winning portrayal of the late Professor Stephen Hawking. The Oscar-friendly elements are all in place: real-life story, mental brilliance, physical disability. But playing Hawking presents its own unique challenges. While Daniel Day-Lewis portrays a man disabled from birth, Redmayne has to capture how Hawking's motor neuron disease develops after it's first diagnosed when he's studying at Cambridge.
What about the brain?
The brain isn't affected. Your thoughts won't change. It's just that eventually no one will know what they are. I'm ever so sorry.
There's a parallel strain of Oscar-winning films about real-life characters whose mental brilliance is accompanied by mental illness. Ron Howard's A Beautiful Mind centres on Russell Crowe's mathematician John Nash, a man who developed paranoid schizophrenia. Unusually, while the film itself won awards for Best Picture and Best Director in 2002, Crowe left the ceremony empty-handed, perhaps as a result of negative campaigning, which claimed that the real-life Nash was an anti-Semite and a vote for Crowe was somehow a vote for Nash.
Well, on the bright side, you've invented window art.
This is a group playing touch football. This is a cluster of pigeons fighting over breadcrumbs. And this here is a woman who was chasing a man who stole her purse.
John, you watched a mugging. That's weird.
In competitive behavior, someone always loses.
However, the following year, Nicole Kidman won Best Actress by a nose for her portrayal of Virginia Woolf in The Hours, suffering from bipolar disorder, but still writing a masterpiece.
This is my right. It is the right of every human being. I choose not the suffocating anesthetic of the suburbs, but the violent jolt of the capital. That is my choice.
Meanwhile, Geoffrey Rush and Jamie Foxx combined piano virtuosity with schizoaffective disorder as David Helf got in Shine, and blindness as Ray Charles in Ray. While these kind of roles have long attracted Oscar attention, more recently it's been argued with some force that characters with disabilities should be played by actors who have similar disabilities. So, for example, if a character uses a wheelchair, who better to play them than an actor who uses a wheelchair? After all, in a world in which talented actors with disabilities are necessarily restricted in their role choices, why should roles for which they are uniquely qualified be taken away from them? If Coming Home were remade today, would John Voight be the first choice for the sexy wheelchair-using Vietnam veteran who gets the girl?
Don't wake him up. Hey. Doc.
In 1987, Marley Matlin, who is deaf, made Oscar history by winning Best Actress for her role as a deaf character in Children of a Lesser God. A remarkable victory, which seemed to offer real hope for change. But this year, the Academy notably failed to nominate rising star Millicent Simmons, who is deaf, for her standout role in A Quiet Place, despite several nominations elsewhere.
When it comes to the Oscars, change happens very slowly.
I meet you today.
In 2010, Colin Firth combined disability with royalty as the stammering George VI in The King's Speech.
In circumstances which are...
Great Men and Women of History is another solid acting awards bet, and it's a category where the Brits in particular have delivered some majestic performances.
Good morning. I'm so sorry to disturb you. I'm just expecting a phone call to be put through here. Out! Oh, there it is. Thank you, Claire.
Helen Mirren's Oscar in 2007 placed her in a line of Academy Award-winning British kings and queens that includes Charles Laughton's Henry VIII and Judi Dench's Elizabeth I. And in 2019, Olivia Colman is hotly tipped for a memorable performance as one of Britain's least memorable monarchs, Queen Anne, in The Favourite.
Maitland, stop.
What?
Stop! Enough! Stop! Be gone! I command it! Leave!
But what about some of our other national treasures? In 2018, the Best Actor Award went to a British star playing a British Prime Minister, Gary Oldman, as Churchill.
How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased, good God, given immense privileges, before we learn? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
It's the kind of serious, showy role for a serious, showy thespian who knows how to deliver a serious, showy speech.
I am the President of the United States of America, clothed in immense power.
And for the Brits also have a nice sideline playing American leaders. Daniel Day-Lewis won an unprecedented third Best Actor award in 2013 for his Abraham Lincoln. Anthony Hopkins' Nixon was nominated back in 1996.
I promised the American people peace with honor in Southeast Asia. Now, that may take time.
And in 2019, Christian Bale is a nominee for his portrayal of Vice President Dick Cheney, a man just a heartbeat away from the Oval Office.
Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
That sounds good.
One of the challenges of making a historical film is to create suspense and drama, despite the fact that the audience knows how the story will end.
Churchill may be Prime Minister, but he also has to be a sympathetic underdog. Darkest Hour emphasises his political weakness as Hitler advances in Europe.
I need not impress upon you the trouble faced by the Western Hemisphere. Without your support in some fashion.
I know. You are on my mind day and night.
It's interesting to compare Darkest Hour to the story of another Prime Minister, The Iron Lady, directed by Phyllida Lloyd, which secured Meryl Streep her third Oscar in 2012.
You've got it in you to go the whole distance.
Absolutely.
What? Prime Minister? Oh, no. Oh, no. In Britain, there will be no female Prime Minister. Yeah, not in my lifetime, no.
While the film isn't afraid to present Margaret Thatcher as a flawed figure, it still requires us to invest in her as a character. So she's depicted as bravely taking on the male public school establishment in the course of her rise to power. Underdog figures are often at the heart of the grand historical epics that sometimes sweep the board at the Academy Awards. Gandhi and Braveheart's William Wallace may have ever so slightly different views about the use of violence, but they're both fighting to secure justice for their people. You can see underdogs in fictional epics too. Maximus in Gladiator is a former Roman general reduced to fighting in the arena.
Father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife. I will have my vengeance in this life or the next.
But Oscar also has a fondness for the little guy, fighting a small battle that embodies a more eternal conflict between freedom and repression. In 1976, the big winner was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, in which Jack Nicholson's psychiatric patient Randall McMurphy comes to represent an everyman struggling against the system, personified by Louise Fletcher's Nurse Ratched.
Chief, he's got his hand up. Look.
No, Mr. McMurphy. When the meeting was adjourned, the vote was 9-9.
Oh, come on, you're not going to say that now. You're not going to say that now. You're going to pull that henhouse shit now in the vote. The chief just voted. It was 10-9. Now I want that television set turned on right now.
These struggles can be against forms of oppression and evil so vast that it's impossible for a single film to capture them. Some other Oscar Best Picture winners, like Schindler's List, have been criticised, wrongly in my opinion, for focusing on stories of survival rather than on the millions more who died or were murdered.
I could have got more out. I could have got more. I don't know if I just...
You luxuriate in his face.
I survive! I will not fall into despair. I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
When it comes to the great historical injustices, it's perhaps hard to imagine that anyone in the audience really needs to be told how terrible they are. As Amy Poehler joked from the Golden Globe stage in 2014, I loved 12 Years a Slave, and I can honestly say that after seeing that film, I will never look at slavery the same way again. In fact, director Steve McQueen does a brilliant job of finding a new way to tell an old story to avoid stating the obvious. He resists the temptation to burden his film and Chiwetel Ejiofor's Solomon Northrup with repeated outbursts about injustice and hope. Sometimes the realities of our hero's struggle are told through music.
Like this.
A striking counterpoint is established between Paul Dano's weaselly, taunting rendition of a song heard in the plantations.
Nigger run, nigger flow.
Everybody say roll, Jordan, roll.
And the slave's defiant graveside rendition of Roll, Jordan, Roll. The latter becoming an epiphanic moment that pierces to the very heart of Northrup's predicament.
My soul arise in heaven, Lord, for the year when Jordan rolls.
Hey, Robbie, everything okay?
I need you to tell me something, Jim. Could it be 90 degrees?
What?
Could it be as high as 90?
A recent Oscar winner about another horrific injustice avoids showing the crime altogether. Spotlight, which won Best Picture in 2016, concerns the widespread sexual abuse of children by Catholic clergy in Massachusetts. Rather than depicting the abuse, Spotlight concentrates instead on the painstaking work of investigative reporters from the Boston Globe to bring the scandal to light.
We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
Spotlight also examines how a wider community may become complicit in an unspoken crime.
This is how it happens, isn't it, Pete?
What's that?
Guy leans on a guy and suddenly the whole town just looks the other way.
The irony, of course, is that Spotlight won Best Picture in 2016, just a year before the Me Too movement accused Hollywood itself of turning a blind eye to persistent sexual abuse within the movie industry. When the Academy awarded Frances McDormand Best Actress in 2018 for her portrayal of a furious, grief-stricken mother in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, it seemed to reflect the mood of the moment.
Hey, fuckhead!
What?
Don't say what, Dixon, when she comes in calling you a fuckhead, and don't you
Shut
come
up!
In here...
Mildred Hayes, whose teenage daughter was raped and murdered, blames the police for failing to solve the crime and incurs the wrath of her local community. In her uniform of a boiler suit, Mildred is quite literally a blue-collar warrior.
I don't think those billboards is very fair.
The time it took you to get out here whining like a bitch, Willoughby, some other poor girl's probably out there being butchered right now, but I'm glad you got your priorities straight. I'll say that for you.
She has predecessors in other working-class female characters seeking justice. Julia Roberts won Best Actress for playing campaigner Erin Brockovich.
Second of all, these people don't dream about being rich. They dream about being able to watch their kids swim in a pool without worrying that they'll have to have a hysterectomy at the age of 20.
As did Jodie Foster for portraying rape survivor Sarah Tobias in The Accused.
Oh,
that's the best you can do, and your best sucks. Now, I don't know what you got for selling me out, but I sure as shit hope it's worth it.
Let's go.
But writer-director Martin McDonagh raises the possibility that Mildred's rage predates the tragedy and that anger was already tearing her family apart.
So how come a week before she died, she comes around asking if she can move in with me at my place? Because she couldn't stand the two of you bitching at each other no more, fighting with each other
no more. Can I believe you?
And I said, no, stay at home. Your mom loves you.
Fuck him.
There's an uncomfortable ambiguity at the heart of Three Billboards, which is maybe why the Academy found it easier to celebrate the performances than the film as a whole. When it comes to the Best Picture Award, Oscar still prefers the moral clarity of films like 12 Years a Slave and Spotlight. In 2004, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, gained access to an elite club, the third and most recent film to win 11 Academy Awards. No picture has ever topped this number, which was first achieved by William Wyler's Ben-Hur in 1960 and then by James Cameron's Titanic in 1998. So does this elevate them to an exclusive tier of artistic excellence? Well, it's worth noting that they're all a certain kind of film, spectacular epics. Now, I nearly said historical epics, but of course, Lord of the Rings isn't historical unless you're somehow watching this in Middle Earth. All three won awards for Best Picture and Best Director, but only Ben-Hur took home any acting awards. And it's interesting to note that all three are classic underdog stories, with slaves, penniless artists, and hobbits at their respective hearts. And if there's one big lesson when you look back at the history of the Academy Awards, it's that Oscar loves an underdog.
Just look at this year's nominees. A Star is Born and Bohemian Rhapsody are classic, all-singing, all-dancing tales of outsiders making it big in showbiz. Roma is an ordinary people tale featuring an extraordinary performance from screen first-timer Jalitza Aparicio as a struggling housemaid in 1970s Mexico. Yeah. Black Klansman and Green Book explore racial prejudice in America in the 60s and 70s.
You know what I'm trying to say.
Chief, some of us can speak King's English, others speak Jive. Ron Stallworth here happens to be fluent in both.
Ryan Coogler's Black Panther also has strong social justice themes. It may be a superhero fantasy, but everything from the design to the narrative to the soundtrack has an empowering, anti-colonial, anti-racist, anti-sexist edge. There's even an underdog element to drive the drama forward. Whether or not you think it's the best film of the year, Black Panther is certainly one of the most groundbreaking, a bona fide blockbuster made by an African-American director with a largely black cast. I also think, most importantly, that it's just a bloody good film. Exciting, adventurous, and unexpected. No wonder it's been a hit with audiences and critics alike. As for Oscar, we'll have to wait and see.